Hello and welcome. My name is Kevin Featherstone and I'm the director of the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics, and it's the observatory which is hosting today's discussion. I'm very pleased to welcome all of you. What has become known as the Cyprus problem has long had recurring international and domestic dimensions. Externally, we can recall the choices made by Britain in the 1950s in the decolonialization process and the consequences of those decisions. We can think of the coup instigated by the Greek colonels in 1974 to bring down President Makarios, followed by the seeming failure of Washington to stop the Turkish invasion of the island, which has divided Cyprus ever since. We can think of the continuation of thousands of Turkish troops based on Cyprus, seen often as a stumbling block to a resolution of the problem. To some, the accession of Cyprus to the European Union in 2004 without a resolution of the Cyprus problem has exacerbated the peace process. Domestically, we can think of the intercommunal violence of the early 1960s, the dislocation of communities, the atrocities of 1974, and the rejection of the Annan peace plan by the Greek Cypriots in 2004. For decades, UN-sponsored talks to solve the Cyprus problem have failed. Just last May, the most recent talks in Geneva broke down. These involved the two communities on the island, plus the so-called guarantor powers, Greece, Turkey, and the UK. Long-standing disputes remain. What form of government should Cyprus have? What of the land rights, property rights, after almost five decades of division and resettlement? In recent times, the discovery of potential energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean has had the potential of recalibrating the Cyprus problem. New maritime zones have been agreed by many nations in the region, though not by Turkey or the Turkish Cypriots. Add to this the conflicts between Greece and Turkey over territorial rights in the Aegean or the flow of refugees, and we can see that the strategic problems remain, the geopolitics remain intense. So where are we now? Are we any closer to a solution? What are the prospects for stability in the region? Does the discovery of gas resources alter the geopolitical balance? Are the strategic interests changing or remaining essentially the same? Our discussion this evening will help to clarify the situation for us, and we have two experts to guide us. Alexandros Zenon has served as the permanent secretary of the Republic of Cyprus for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from 2006 to 2008 and from 2013 to 2018. In between those two periods, he was High Commissioner for Cyprus here in London from 2015 until 2018. And he was the coordinator for counterterrorism and anti-ISIS policies on behalf of the Republic. He's been advisor to the Greek alternate Minister of Migration and Asylum, and previously he has served as ambassador in Italy and the Netherlands. He is the senior practitioner of Cypriot diplomacy, offering us the insider's view. Emmanuel Cariani is a reader in international security at the King's College London in the Department of Defense Studies. He obtained his PhD in Islamic theology from King's College London and a PhD in political science from the University of Hull. He's held research positions at Oxford University, the US Military Academy at West Point, the LSE, Princeton, Yale, and Columbia. He brings us the informed academic perspective to our discussion. Before we get underway, let me emphasize that we invite you watching us this evening to send us your Twitter comments, and we suggest the hashtag for today's event as hashtag LSE Cyprus. Let me also say that this discussion is being recorded, and we would hope to make it available online from the LSE's Hellenic Observatory website as soon as we can. I'm going to invite our two speakers to make their opening presentations. I will then ask them questions, and we'll open it to you, the audience, for your Q&A, for your questions coming to us. The audience can send us your questions using the Q&A facility at the bottom of your screens if you're watching on Zoom, or if you're watching on Facebook, please use the comment facility. I've tried to get through as many questions as possible. Please keep your questions as short as you can, but tell us who you are and where you're watching us from. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Alexandros Zenon to make an opening statement of about 20 minutes, and Emmanuel Karyanis will follow with a presentation of about 15 minutes. We look forward to the questions coming in from the audience. Alexandre, over to you and welcome.
Good evening, Kevin. Good evening, everybody from Athens. I'm very delighted after many years to be back at Houghton Street, albeit virtually and from a distance of more than 1,500 miles. I would like, first of all, to thank you, Kevin, and the Hellenic Observatory for giving me the opportunity to speak on a topical subject, such as stability in Eastern Mediterranean. Topical, of course, it has been for many decades. What I shall focus on today is how Cyprus has tried and endeavored to make its contribution to promoting security and stability in its part of the world, despite adversities and difficulties. It is often said that geography is destiny, and it is a great truth. Geography is given and cannot be changed. What can change are some elements related to geography, which allow us to play a positive role in our regional context. I'll show you a map. It dates back, I don't know if you can see it, it dates back to the mid-1950s, during the Suez Crisis and the Ioka struggle in Cyprus, and was issued to British servicemen stationed in Cyprus. This map demonstrates and explains to them in a very simple manner why they were on the island and Cyprus's strategic importance. Not much has changed ever since. It shows the distance of Cyprus from the oil fields of Iraq, from the Suez Canal, from aroused Greece, as it says, and troubled Jordan and other countries in the region. Cyprus is situated, as you can see, in the strategic point of the entrance to the Suez Canal, the route through which oil and gas exports from the region travel to Europe and other parts of the world, other destinations. It is, in fact, at the crossroads of three continents: the volatile region of Eastern Mediterranean, one of the most insecurity and instability prone areas in the world. It is the region where international terrorism and Islamic radicalism were born in their present form. In the early second decade of 2000, the political context in the region was defined by a number of new facts, which made the need for stability and security even more evident and urgent. The so-called Arab Spring and the collapse of various regimes led to further destabilization of the region. the emergence of ISIS in Syria and Iraq, the Iranian nuclear program, and the influence Iran exerts through Hezbollah in Lebanon and on the Syrian regime, the deterioration of relations between Turkey and Israel after the Mavi Marmara incident, and between Turkey and Egypt because of the support that the Erdogan regime had given to the Muslim Brotherhood. And last but not least, what was mentioned by Kevin before, the discovery of hydrocarbon reserves in the exclusive economic zones of various countries in the Eastern Mediterranean basin. This situation highlighted the need for closer cooperation between countries in the region in order to deal more effectively with the serious challenges that had emerged. At the same time, it defined the potential geopolitical role of Cyprus. We saw in this situation opportunities which we were willing and ready to seize and make our contribution to the security and stability in the region. Cyprus has the advantage that always maintained excellent relations with all its neighbors. Well, except one, the moderate ones in particular. It is part of the region's history and its traditions and has better understanding of their mentality, their problems, and their needs. In previous years, before its accession to the European Union, Cyprus proved how, in certain cases, can be useful, some would say instrumental and indispensable, in managing and resolving regional crises. Allow me a few examples. In 2002, it was Cyprus's decision that was at the request of the United States and the European Union to temporarily host the Palestinian fighters who had sought refuge in the Basilica of the Nativity of Bethlehem. As a result, a major crisis was diffused with Israel, and the further escalation and possibly bloodshed were avoided. The repatriation through Cyprus during the Lebanon crisis in the summer of 2006 of more than 65,000 foreigners is another example. A successful operation that led to the signing of agreements between Cyprus and other EU member states, but also with non-EU countries for the evacuation and repatriation of their citizens if the need arises because of the situation in Syria or any other country in the region. Again in 2006, the establishment of the UNIFIL Maritime Task Force in Cyprus for the monitoring of the territorial waters of Lebanon. In 2013, the removal and destruction of Syria's chemical weapon arsenal, when the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons established its base in Cyprus. These operations could not have been possible without Cyprus's cooperation and contribution. And I must say that no international convention or agreement obliged us to cooperate. It was voluntary and the result of our political will. Following the 2013 presidential election in Cyprus, the new administration adopted a more assertive, unambiguous, and predictable foreign policy with clear options, which I would summarize in one phrase. Cyprus, as an EU member state, belongs to the West, and for that matter, to the Western security system. This policy, which we immediately began to implement, was based on three main pillars: cooperation in the field of security with regional and non-regional partners, cooperation on the exploration and the exploitation of hydrocarbons, and promoting of closer regional cooperation. I shall take them one by one. On security, as a first step, we sought admission to the Partnership for Peace, the PFP, a NATO program of cooperation in determined fields between individual Euro-Atlantic countries and NATO. Despite our best efforts and support from major NATO members, we were faced with the veto of one member state, the only one whose name begins with a T. We did not despair and decided instead to proceed bilaterally with willing NATO member countries, the United Kingdom, the United States, Greece, France, and in some cases, Italy, and promote such cooperation in the field of regional security. Over the years, this cooperation gradually expanded and covered areas such as the fight against terrorism at a time when the serious threat from ISIS was emerging in neighboring Syria, illegal migration, human trafficking, and organized international crime, the proliferation of prohibited materials and weapons, and the monitoring of compliance with EU sanctions, to mention only a few. As a result, we managed to intercept and stop 18 so-called foreign fighters and terrorists on their way to or from ISIS control areas via Turkey, and in other cases of 30 others who had landed within the boundaries of the British bases, only 100 yards from the airfield from which Royal Air Force jets were taking off to operate against ISIS. And I am telling this for the first time. In the same way, Cypriot security services discovered 9.5 tons of highly explosive nitrate ammonium, which targeted Israeli and Western interests. Also, in other similar cases, terrorist attacks were prevented in European countries, including in the UK. The terrorist threat from ISIS in Syria led also to enhanced and closer cooperation between Cypriot authorities and the British bases, as it was mutually acknowledged that in the prevailing circumstances, the security of the bases is the security of Cyprus, and the security of Cyprus is the security of the bases. During the same period, the Republic of Cyprus, in close cooperation with the United States and France, offered military materiel worth more than 50 million euros to Jordan, Lebanon, and the Kurdish regional government to assist them in their fight against ISIS and other affiliated terrorist groups, and that at the time when Cyprus was facing its worst economic crisis. Many were also the cases where Cypriot authorities, in cooperation with the United States and the United Kingdom, intercepted, stopped, and turned back vessels or aircraft, violating sanctions against Syria, against the Syrian regime, or illegally transporting and trading oil from civil war-torn Libya. The picture would not be complete without a brief reference to Israel and its security. You know that for Israel, security is above all. Israel is, in fact, our next-door neighbor. We are the only EU member state adjacent to this country. We share with them the same values of democracy and respect for the rule of law. Cyprus is, in my view, the most predictable neighbor of Israel the only country that is not party to the Middle East conflict, and the only one that is not potentially fundamentalist for now or ever. We have no differences with Israel or its adversaries in the region. While in times of peace, Israel considers us as its strategic depth for humanitarian and non-military purposes. Our policy on the Palestinian issue is compartmentalized, and this has been explained to and respected by all sides involved. This gives us the advantage, if the need arises, to be listened to and act as honest brokers between opposing sides in the region. Hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbon discovery in the exclusive economic zones of various countries in the region was a new factor and game changer in Eastern Mediterranean. A new element that could be a catalyst for regional stability and prosperity, provided, of course, that all interested parties act according to and abide by the rules of international law and of the law of the sea. According to the American Geological Survey, in the Levantine Basin and the Nile Delta, that is in the exclusive economic zones of different neighboring countries, exist 3.4 billion barrels of oil and 345 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Part of it is in the EEZ of Cyprus. No country alone can fully exploit competitively its own resources. Infrastructure for exploration and exploitation of hydrocarbons cost billions, while reservoirs below the EEZs overlap and pipelines should pass through waters over which other countries have sovereign rights or exercise jurisdiction. The need for stability and security to prevail through regional cooperation became therefore necessary in order to facilitate the full and more competitive exploitation of these resources by all countries concerned. A cooperation that is not only limited to economic gains, but extends to energy security and energy supply of the parties and benefits Europe with new sources and new routes from Eastern Mediterranean, meaning also less dependence on Russian gas. As a first step, in the early 2000s, we concluded EEZ delimitation agreements with neighboring countries, with Egypt, Lebanon, and Israel. We did everything by the book, that is, in accordance with international law, and in particular, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. At the time, and at the later stage also, we invited Turkey to do the same. They refused. But we had to continue despite Turkey's boycotting and undermining our energy program. Time matters because hydrocarbons are gradually being phased out, are losing their value, and will eventually be replaced by renewable sources of energy. Two concrete examples which we promoted of regional cooperation are the Eurasia Interconnector and the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum. The Eurasia Interconnector is a network that will connect power grids of three countries, Cyprus, Greece, and Israel, via the world's longest submarine power cable from Israel to Cyprus, and then from Cyprus to Greece, a total distance of more than 1,200 kilometers, which is approximately 750 miles. It is a major project of common interest of the European Union, and is expected to finish by the end of 2024. Once completed, it will end electricity isolation of Cyprus, which is the last non-interconnected EU member state. The other example is the East Mediterranean Gas Forum. The East Mediterranean Gas Forum was established in 2019 by Cyprus, Egypt, France, Greece, Israel, Italy, Jordan, and Palestine as members, and the United States, the European Union, and the World Bank as observers. It is an international organization which supports its members in deploying full potential of gas resources and create revenues, since it is clear and obvious that it can only be unlocked if suppliers, buyers, and transit countries cooperate on developing an infrastructure within the region and with external markets. Furthermore, bilateral cooperation in this field exists between Cyprus and Israel and Cyprus and Egypt. More recently, between Egypt and Greece as well. As you can see, in less than a decade, despite difficulties, we have created the legal, institutional, and political framework in order to make hydrocarbons a factor of stability. It is our desire and wish that other countries, instead of acting as a destabilizing factor and in violation of international law, join us and our regional partners in this effort. Very briefly now on the trilateral cooperation. The lack of a regional forum of cooperation in the Eastern Mediterranean became more evident in the turbulent aftermath of the Arab Spring, or of the so-called Arab Spring. Its consequences and the ensuing need for stability and security triggered, beginning in mid-2013, the establishment of trilateral mechanisms between two EU member states, Cyprus and Greece on the one hand, and individual countries of the region on the other, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Palestine. The idea of Foreign Minister Ioannis Kasoulides was to engage and bring together neighboring influential moderate countries, some of them facing the risk of instability and overthrow, with like-mindedness and converging positions in foreign policy, and establish between them an informal forum of dialogue and cooperation. Such cooperation would also be a means of promoting objectives of the European neighborhood policy. The EU needs to engage with trustworthy and moderate interlocutors with influence in the region and beyond. The opposite is also true. Trilaterals introduce a new dimension in the regional context. Cyprus, and for that matter, Greece, are ideally placed and qualified for such a role. No hidden agendas, long-standing and privileged relations with Arab states and Israel, which are countries of primary interest of the EU and of the United States. Knowing and understanding the region better, its culture and mentality, as well as its problems, they trust us while we have maintained with them excellent relations for many decades. And of course, the Middle East is, together with Europe, our vital economic space. It is a unique combination, in my view, because geography places us in Eastern Mediterranean, but politically we belong to the EU. We saw this as an opportunity for us, for Europe, and for our neighbors. common objective of all trilateral mechanisms, it was mentioned before, is security and stability. But each one of them has its own contents, its own identity and characteristics, its own priorities, and its own pace of implementation. It is what the French call a géométrie variable. They adapt to each participant's needs and conditions. With Egypt, a leading Arab country, priority was placed on energy, tourism, illegal migration, agriculture, and countering terrorism, to mention a few areas of cooperation. Israel's main concern is security, I said it already. So emphasis was given to this field. And at the same time, there are synergies on health matters, wildfire fighting, environment, startups, innovation and new technologies, as well as between the respective diasporas. With Jordan, immediate priority was given to projects alleviating the consequences and the burden from the refugee crisis, including a €500,000 program in scholarships for refugee students to study in Cypriot academic institutions. Other fields of cooperation with the Hashemite Kingdom are tourism, protection of cultural heritage, water management, and renewable sources of energy. Last but not least, Cyprus offered military assistance worth €11 million to the Jordanian armed forces to be used in the framework of the Aqaba process, an initiative of King Abdullah to counter terrorism in the Horn of Africa. I did not mention the two other trilaterals, the one with Lebanon and the one with Palestine. Political and other conditions prevailing there do not allow to proceed with the desired pace. Nevertheless, we continue the effort despite the difficulties and the handicaps that slow down or sometimes stall progress. Beyond cooperation with all participants in such diverse fields, what is equally important is the fact that it allowed us to engage with them in a regular political dialogue on issues of common and European interest. 8 years have passed since we established the first trilateral cooperation mechanism, the one with Egypt. During these years, many summits, ministerial and senior officials' meetings have taken place. Cooperation proceeds at different place with each participating country, because not all of them are the same. Other countries, especially from the Gulf, but also from beyond the region, like the United States, France, and Italy, expressed their interest and participated in sectoral meetings of special interest to them. Taking into account the difficulties and the problems afflicting the region, we know that this is an ambitious exercise. But considering what is at stake, we believe that it is also reason to persevere, especially now that new challenges and threats of destabilization emerge in the Mediterranean. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandria, very much. That's very clear and comprehensive. It gives us a very nice map of the things to be discussed later. Can I now then pass over to Emmanuel for his response?
Good evening. Thank you very much for the invitation. So I was a visiting senior fellow at the Hellenic Observatory 5 years ago. Good to be back, even virtually. For the next 10-15 minutes, I would like to discuss some theoretical perspectives on the question of energy and security in the Eastern Mediterranean. So the ambassador, as a practitioner, gave us very interesting insights about policies, about interstate relations. As an academic, I would like to focus more on how theory can help us understand regional geopolitics, especially when it comes to the question of energy. So let me upload a very short presentation. I hope you can see it. Yes. Kevin, can you see it? Yes. Okay, great. So there are some significant gas finds since 2009. As you can see here, most of the gas is located in the exclusive economic zone of Egypt. But it was first Israel that discovered some important, some significant gas fields in its exclusive economic zone. Cyprus, it's the other gas producing, potential gas producing country. And we know that there's probably some gas in the sea area between Lebanon and Israel. But also there is some gas probably off the coast of Gaza, the Gaza Strip. So we don't really know how much gas exists in this part of the world. There is an estimate that the ambassador mentioned earlier. So according to the US Department of Energy, more or less we have 122 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in the region. And this estimate doesn't include Greece's potential reserves in the sea area south of Crete. So from what we know now, the Eastern Mediterranean region might have two Norways, might have the gas of two Norways. Practically speaking, that means that the Eastern Mediterranean region can play a very important role in the future as an alternative source of gas for the European Union. Currently, as most of you know, Russia is the country that almost dominates European gas imports. So something like 40 to 50% of our imports come from Russia. And Norway is the second most important provider with something like 20% of our gas imports. So the Eastern Mediterranean cannot probably replace Russia. Russia will remain an important source of gas for the European Union, but it can play a very important role as an alternative source of gas. And this is the map. Okay. Now, there are three schools of thought regarding energy security. So IR theories can tell us something about energy security, about how energy can influence relations between two countries, et cetera, et cetera. So one very central belief of this realist school of thought is that energy is a national security issue. So realist scholars will understand anything relating to energy, from oil and gas exploitation to nuclear energy to renewables, as a national security issue. Now, if you think that this is an exaggeration, try to imagine organized human life without energy. Without energy, we cannot have what we have now. We cannot have any economic activity. So realist scholars don't believe that this is an exaggeration. They believe that energy is vital for any economic activity, which practically means that without energy, any country will suffer, any country will collapse. Now, real scholars are also proponents of the so-called peak oil thesis. So the peak oil thesis, for those that are not really familiar with the oil and gas market, claims that we are running out of oil and gas. So if this is true, if we are running out of oil and gas, countries must do whatever is possible to secure energy resources at an affordable price. So the peak oil thesis, in a way, will explain why real scholars tend to understand energy as a security issue. Another central belief of this realist school of thought is that energy companies, even private energy companies, are the long arm of governments. So from this point of view, it doesn't matter if ExxonMobil is a private company. What matters is that ExxonMobil is an American company. From this point of view, it doesn't matter if Total Elfina is a private French-Belgian company. What matters is that this company is registered in France, so that will make it the long arm of the French government. Okay, let me briefly describe the next school of thought, which is the liberalist school of thought. So from the liberalist point of view, liberalization of energy markets, it's a must. It's a must because energy, more than anything else, it's a commodity. So liberalist scholars will understand energy not as a national security issue, but they will understand more the economic practicalities of energy. They will treat energy as a commodity, nothing more than a commodity, because from their point of view, first of all, makes no difference if we are running out of oil and gas, simply because we will replace one day oil and gas with alternative sources of energy, including even nuclear energy. So they tend to be, let's say, less dramatic. They tend to understand energy as just another important commodity, like gold, like copper, like you know, other resources. Another central belief of this liberalist school of thought is that energy dependence is a good thing. It's a good thing because with independence, we have economies of scale, we have more stability, and at the end of the day, the European Union was based on energy dependence. I will remind you that before the European Union and the European Community, we had the European Coal and Steel Community in the 50s. So the European Coal and Steel Community was partly about energy cooperation. So liberalists will claim that energy interdependence is not a bad thing. Interdependence will not undermine the national security of any country. Energy interdependence is good for consumers, it's good for governments, it's good for regional stability. And one more important element of this school of thought is that energy cooperation could potentially solve political disputes. Of course, again, the good example that I can mention is the European Community, but from time to time, we can see manifestations of this belief in various policy proposals. Like during the 90s, there was a proposal, the Clinton administration made a proposal to build a peace pipeline between Armenia and Azerbaijan to solve the Nagorno-Karabakh crisis. The Americans, the Europeans aggressively promoted the idea of a peace pipeline between India and Pakistan. And of course, nowadays we have an idea circulating here and there about building a pipeline between Cyprus and Turkey to solve the Cyprus question. So the liberalist school of thought has a rather optimistic approach to energy security. They tend to be, let's say, more not necessarily pragmatic, but they tend to be more engaging, more positive about the possibility of energy exploitation, energy transportation, as opposed to the realist school of thought that they always have a zero-sum game in their mind, and they tend to understand security, energy security, as just another manifestation of national security. Last but not least, we have the constructivist school of thought. So the constructivist school of thought will claim that many countries have securitized energy. They have securitized energy for various reasons, but securitization of energy is a bad thing. It's a bad thing because it will create more tension, more instability. I have here an interesting quote. I found it in a journal article. Energy security is what states make of it. So the author paraphrased a famous quote that the security is what states make of it, a famous quote by a constructivist author. So energy security is basically what you know, we want to construct, we want to present. And that means that sometimes countries will have a pessimistic or an optimistic approach, depending on domestic politics, depending on foreign policy objectives. But in practice, that means that energy security means different things to different people. And one more thing that I will have to include in this constructivist school of thought is energy identities. So many countries have been very keen to build an energy identity. Some countries would like to portray themselves as credible producers, like, for example, Russia. Russia has been very keen to present itself as a reliable and credible producer, no matter sanctions, no matter what is the kind of relation with the European Union. We have some other countries like Turkey that have tried really hard to portray themselves as reliable transit countries. Greece also, it's one of potential transit countries that has also been very keen to build such an identity. So this is, let's say, another studied aspect of the constructivist school of energy security. But we know that, yes, some countries have tried to build such energy identities. So let's try very briefly to understand how these three schools of thought can apply to the energy, the Eastern Mediterranean energy environment. So first, some virtual images to get us into the mood. Anastasiades, the president of the Republic of Cyprus, General Tsitsi, the president of Egypt, and Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Greek prime minister. So the realist school of thought will claim that it's all about power. Whatever happens in the Eastern Mediterranean when it comes to energy, it's about power. And indeed, there is growing interest from great powers like France, like the UK, like Russia, like the United States, because from a realist point of view, the East Med gas is very strategic. So although there is not so much gas in the region in comparison to Russia or Iran or Qatar, there is enough gas to make a difference. And a good, you know, a good manifestation of this a growing interest is the very presence of some important energy, Western energy companies. So from a realist point of view, the fact that very soon ExxonMobil will start exploiting Cypriot gas, it's a proof of USA interest in the region. And the same goes with French companies, British companies, Russian companies, et cetera, et cetera. From a realist point of view, also, there is another fact that we need to acknowledge, that currently, whether we like it or not, we have two blocks of countries in the region. I will call them the haves and the have-nots. So we have producers and potential transit countries, producers like Israel, Cyprus, and Egypt, together with Greece, which is a potential transit country, coming together, trying to use energy not only as an area of cooperation, but to use energy as a means to improve defense cooperation, to improve diplomatic cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. So we do have a block of countries. I will not call it an alliance, because I think an alliance, at least for those that are familiar with IR theory, it's something much bigger, much more important, but we do have a block of countries based on common energy interests that has tried really hard to coordinate efforts, at least in the energy sector. And at the same time, we have another block of countries. I will call it the have-nots. So Turkey, Lebanon, and the Gaza Strip, meaning Hamas, basically. Three actors, some of them state actors, some others are not state actors, like Hamas, that currently feel isolated, they feel marginalized. And if this is true, this fact that we have the haves and the have-nots can, from a realist point of view, explain tensions and can explain why we have so much instability in the region. One more important piece of evidence, let's say, for the realist point of view, is that we can currently observe a militarization of the Eastern Mediterranean. So not only we have the strong naval presence of the United States, of France, of Britain, of Russia, of great powers, but we have also countries like Turkey, Greece, Egypt, Israel, trying to build navies, trying to build actually blue water navies. So even the decision of the Greek government, the recent decision of the Greek government to acquire advanced French warboats, from a realist point of view, counts as a piece of evidence towards that direction. And one more thing that I will have to mention here is that Turkey, again, from the realist point of view, I will keep repeating this because I will present three different perspectives. From a realist point of view, it's currently facing an energy dilemma. So what is good for Cyprus? It's bad for Turkey. And what is good for Turkey is bad for Cyprus from an energy point of view. So Turkey, if this is true, if Turkey is facing an energy dilemma, from an IR point of view, that means that we might be in a position to predict what Turkey can do next. If there is an energy security dilemma, that means that, okay, we can expect more escalation, we can expect more tension. From a liberalist point of view, it's not about power, it's about money. Of course, some of you will tell me now that money is power and power is money, but I couldn't come up with a better way to describe it. So liberalist scholars will claim that we don't need to focus too much on governments. What we need to understand here is the role of big energy corporations. So why we have so many important energy companies investing resources, investing financial resources in the Eastern Mediterranean? Where we have ExxonMobil, where we have Total Alfina, even Qatar Petroleum, which is a state-owned company. Why? Because there is an energy crisis as we speak. Okay. We don't have enough gas. The Eastern Mediterranean is one of the most underexploited areas in the world. So, of course, from an economic point of view, it makes sense to expect a strong interest there. So it has nothing to do with governments. From a liberalist point of view, this is about energy exploitation and nothing else. This is about investing money. This is about making profits. This is just business. At the same time, yes, there is something like an EastMed energy community. So there is energy cooperation, there is interdependence, and this is a good thing. So what the ambassador mentioned about the establishment of the EastMed gas forum based in Cairo, this is good news. This is good news. From a liberalist point of view, this is good news. Why? Because more interdependence means more stability, it means basically more peace, it means more opportunities. And if this is true, we have even a great opportunity as we speak to use gas transportation. Okay, so the ambassador mentioned this gas, this EastMed pipeline. There are other projects when it comes to transportation of gas, but we can use gas transportation to solve important political disputes like the Cyprus problem, is what I was telling you earlier about the peace pipeline. So we do have an opportunity there to use gas in a positive way to solve problems, the Cyprus problem, or even the Gaza problem, meaning, you know, the problem that the Israelis have with Hamas. So yes, it's about money, but we can use money, we can utilize this wealth to build a better world, to build a more stable region. Last but not least, let's try to see what is the application of the constructivist school of thought.
Can you make it very brief, Emmanuel, please?
Yes, very briefly, sorry. So the constructivist school of thought will claim that there is a securitization of energy in Greece, Cyprus, Turkey, Lebanon, and Israel, but not in Egypt. So the Egyptians, for different reasons, for their own reasons, are not so keen to securitize energy. But in all those countries, the Eastern Mediterranean has been portrayed as the new El Dorado, as the new energy frontier. And those energy resources have been perceived as a great opportunity for those countries to solve their financial difficulties. Okay. One more thing that I'll have to mention, and it will be my concluding point, is that in those countries, the exclusive economic zone has been perceived as an extension of sovereignty. So for many different reasons, all of those countries, including Egypt this time, will understand their exclusive economic zone not as an area where they have certain sovereign rights and they can exploit resources, but as an extension of their territory. That's why we will currently observe the equivalent rhetoric. So when the Turkish warboats will enter the Cypriot exclusive economic zone, newspapers will claim that this is a third Attila. The Turks will understand whatever happens in the region as an effort to isolate Turkey from the EastMed and to make Turkey a marginalized country. So this kind of rhetoric can, in a way, prove that there is securitization of energy in the region. And this is my final point.
Thank you very much indeed, and apologies for hurrying you along at the end, but that complements very nicely. I wonder if I can start off to both of you with, I guess, a rather obvious question. That is that after COP26 and all of the discussions about future energy and climate change, etc., you're both essentially saying that the discovery of hydrocarbon energy reserves in the Eastern Mediterranean can be a lever geostrategically within the region and can help the Cyprus to overcome the Cyprus problem. The obvious question after COP26 is to say, as I think Alexandros acknowledged, the future value of these reserves, we can expect to be falling. So is this an opportunity which is about to be missed because of the value of the reserves declining in the long term? How much of a lever can it be if we're switching from hydrocarbons? Alexandra, do you want to go first?
Well, it's a big question, Kevin. The fact is that the hydrocarbons are being phased out. I think there is a deadline. I'm not sure if this is 2030. So by then, by 2030, or maybe sometime later, they have to be replaced by renewable sources of energy. Now, some countries have already begun to this transformation. That is why I said that time matters in the exploitation of hydrocarbons. Now, I mentioned some figures, American figures at the beginning. If they are true, it is roughly one third of the total Russian reserves, which is not bad, provided they are all recoverable and can be monetized in time and all that. That is why, and these reserves are in the exclusive economic zones of various countries, basic Egypt, Israel, and Cyprus. That is why cooperation and combined efforts are needed to exploit these reserves in time for monetizing them, exporting them to whether for use in internal markets, Egypt or Cyprus or Israel, or part of it to Europe. And that is why the project, the EastMed project, was recognized as a project of common interest for the European Union. And the feasibility study was financed with 2.5 million euros by the European Commission. So, and since I saw a question about dependence, how it relates to dependence on Russian gas, yes, if we manage to properly explore all these reserves, it can partly lessen dependence on Russian gas and all the problems therein involved.
Okay, thank you. Emmanuel, do you want to comment on that, that the value of hydrocarbons is declining?
Yeah, very briefly. Yes, you are right. I mean, the future is not oil and gas. And I think this is not just about climate change. The society, at least Western societies, you know, they have a different vision nowadays. But the big question is how to go there. I mean, we cannot just have renewables. I mean, it will take time. We need to make investments. So natural gas, we know that is more environmental friendly than oil. And gas, as we speak, for most countries, is the transit fuel. So for the next 20 to 30 years, gas will be the dominant source of fuel, whether we like it or not. After 20, 30 years, yes, of course, yes. I mean, renewables will be the most important source of energy, but for the time being, we cannot ignore natural gas.
Okay, good, thank you. Alexandra, you spoke very clearly about a set of cooperation networks for Cyprus within the region. Cyprus as a key geostrategic location. And you emphasize that Cyprus has good relations with each of its neighbors, with the exception of Turkey. And Emmanuel has shown us the map of exclusive economic zones, and he's talked about basically two sets of alliances, the haves and the have-nots. And he's spoken about the sense of threat that Turkey may have in terms of its dilemma. So if I could again start with Alexandros, if I may, does this multiplicity of cooperative networks, this network of alliances, is actually helping stability or creating a sense of threat, of encirclement for Turkey?
Well, I avoided using the word alliance because it has a military notion. The trilateral mechanisms of cooperation, as I described them and as they are not military forms of cooperation. Yes, there is a, so to speak, military component in the sense that if there is need, military will be used to deal with terrorism, asymmetric threats, trafficking, and all that. But in no case these mechanisms of cooperation are against any other country in the region. It's purely political. It's about cooperation for promoting stability. And Turkey has been invited time and again to participate, provided that accepts the terms and conditions and the framework within these cooperations were established and work. That is international law and the law of the sea.
Sorry, if I may, apologies, but doesn't the recent reaction of Turkey indicate that it actually feels threatened?
Yes, but it's unjustifiable. There is no, I mean, even naval exercises which have taken place in recent years had nothing to do with Turkey. They were to protect drilling platforms against piracy, against illegal trafficking, against terrorism, and all that. It was about security. There was nothing in them against any third country. And I really cannot understand why Turkey is worried about these cooperations. That's why I was, I mean, not only today, but all along, we have never used the word or the term alliance, because alliance has a notion of a coalition against someone, third party. Yes. It's not the case. It's not the case at all.
Okay. Emmanuel, you use the phrase Turkey's dilemma. Do you see the networks, the cooperation networks that Cyprus has created as being some kind of alliance threat to Turkey?
You know, it's really difficult to be objective here because I'm Greek, so I will not pretend that I'm totally neutral. But the truth of the matter is that there is a politicization of energy. So Cypriot politicians openly admitted that energy can be a game-changing factor when it comes to the resolution of the Cyprus problem. Mm. So the fact that the Cypriot leadership, you know, openly made this claim, I think I'm trying to, you know, to avoid creating a diplomatic incident with the ambassador, but it was
this is the LSE, we're full of diplomatic.
Yes, it was, I think, inevitable to have tensions, because what matters here is perceptions. So The perception in Turkey is that, okay, energy will be used for political purposes by the Republic of Cyprus. And it was the first time after 1974 that Turkey was not in a position to dictate its terms. So I think Turkey became insecure, not so much by observing naval exercises, because the Turks, have the self-confidence to understand that, you know, this is not an aggressive move or anything. But the very fact that a small country, a country like the Republic of Cyprus, that one third of it is currently occupied, had a new card, had the initiative, took the initiative to build new relationships and basically to use energy not just for economic purposes but also for political purposes, I think this fact changed perceptions in Turkey and basically produce a reaction. Let's call it a reaction.
Okay. But implicitly,
may I add something to what?
Please.
It was in December 2014 when Mrs. Mogherini visited Ankara and met with Erdogan, that Erdogan said that nothing should happen in Eastern Mediterranean without Turkey's consent. Mm. And that was circulated among member states by Mrs. Mogherini. So this explains, and I would not disagree with Professor Karyanis, that it is not that Turkey is feeling threatened. It is because Turkey wants to control Eastern Mediterranean. So it is not only about hydrocarbons, it's much larger than that.
Okay, thank you. I want to come on to some of the questions that have been sent in by our audience, and I'll try to take them in some kind of thematic order. So Alexandros Zakariadis asks a question to the ambassador, and he says, Ambassador, you argue that Cypriot foreign policy has a pro-Western orientation. However, how feasible would it be for Cyprus to have such an orientation when Russian money is so vital to the Cypriot economy, particularly to the higher echelons of the Greek Cypriot political and economic class?
Right. Well, I think I have answered that already during my first statement, and by examples I have I believe demonstrated how Cypriot foreign policy has changed since 2013, with very concrete examples. I think Mr. Zakariadis is overestimating how he put it, dependence of the Cypriot economy on Russian capitals. Since 2013, I mean, after the economic crisis, and one of the reasons of the economic crisis were the Russian money in Cyprus. I think the Cypriot banking system and the economy more general have been sanitized. We have applied the highest international and European standards because we know that we are constantly being monitored, and because we recognized as a result of the crisis that it was not a healthy economic system. There is much less dependence on Russian funds now, but we are living in a globalized world, in a globalized economy. So if the money is clean, it's welcome, irrespective of its the country of origin. And once we apply standards for control of the origin of the money, I see no harm in Russian or, for that matter, any other country's investments in Cyprus. It is not the only EU member state, Cyprus, that is in this economic relationship with Russia. I remember when I was High Commissioner in London, there was an article in it was either FT or The Economist, I cannot remember, which described Limassol, my birthplace, as Limassol grad, because of the presence of Russians. And in my response to the journal, I said that Limassol is no less grad than Kensington grad or Chelsea grad.
Or indeed Chelsea Football Club, perhaps. Thank you. We're going to run out of time, so I'm going to go and invite you to go quickly, but I would like to come on to some of the other questions which have inevitably arisen, and these concern the way in which the Cyprus problem, as it were, is turning out. And Takis Ioakimidis, from emeritus professor from the University of Athens, asks the ambassador to offer some comments on what Mr. Droutsiotis has called the crime of Crans-Montana. Let me try to give a little bit of context here as to what I think Takis is referring to. And that is that I believe in the Cypriot press in the last week, in the Cyprus Mail, there's been coverage of minutes being made public from the July 2017 meeting between the Cypriot presidents and the UN Secretary General in Switzerland, in Crans-Montana. And one of the articles in the Cypriot press was talking about the lost opportunity and the poor negotiating skills of the Cyprus president, and raised the question, does the Cyprus president actually want a comprehensive agreement? I guess the question really is to what extent Crans-Montana in July 2017 was a lost opportunity for Cyprus, and whether it was the result of some inept strategy. Alexandra, just briefly, if you can.
Yes. Well, I haven't read the book of Mr. Droutsiotis. It's not available, at least in Athens, it's not available yet. So I cannot make any comment on its contents. I have my own information on, at least on a couple of points, on what has happened in Crans-Montana. And since I have finished my book, which is going to be published early next year, I have a chapter on Crans-Montana. So I would advise Mr. Ioakimidis to wait and read what I recount, from a very well placed and independent source on what happened in Crans-Montana. On the documents, you remember that famous Yes Minister series. I think it was Sir Humphrey Appleby who once said that the purpose of minutes is not to register what happened, but is to protect people. So I am a bit reserved about to accept not the authenticity, they are authentic, but if it is true, what is recounted in those minutes or not. But since I have my own source, a very senior source, not Cypriot, not Greek, I have a chapter in my book, and I'll send a copy to Mr. Ioakimidis when it is published.
Thank you. The LSE is always delighted to act as the pre-publicity for an upcoming book, and pleased to accept the increased sales of your book in lieu of a fee for this evening.
Well, I'm not sure, but I think I'll make a lot of enemies, but this is besides that.
We look forward. Konstantin Burkhaya asks, perhaps, Emmanuel, you would like to take this question. What should we make of the increasing military and economic presence of China in the region, not least in the ports of Greece and in Cyprus?
No, this is a really good question because the Greek government, as we speak, has tried rather hard to explain its position. The truth of the matter is that the presence of China in Greece, I'm not so familiar with the situation in Cyprus, but when it comes to Greece, the presence, the economic presence of China was welcomed initially by all political parties, because I will remind you that during the financial crisis, there were not so many countries willing to invest in the Greek economy. But currently, the whole thing has become a political issue. When Foreign Minister Dendias visited London last month, he gave a talk at Roussi, and he admitted that one of the things that his counterparts will always ask and trying to somehow convince the government, the Greek government, to do something about it, is the question of China, the question of Chinese investments. Mm. When it comes to Chinese military presence, there is none of it in the Mediterranean, but there is Chinese military presence in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Horn of Africa, but in the Mediterranean, I can assure you that there is none of it. Of course, there is strong Chinese interest, even for security issues, but we don't have any security presence like Chinese mercenaries, private security companies. Okay. We do have Chinese private military companies in Sudan, in Djibouti, but not in any Mediterranean country,
okay,
as far as I know.
Thanks very much. We're going to run out of time. I'm going to try to squeeze in two more questions, if I may. And this is from Panos Mavroidis to Alexandros, if I may. And he asks, why have Greece and Cyprus failed to finalize the exclusive economic zone agreement between them in all these years? Just a short answer, if Ambassador, please.
Well, this is my personal view. I'm not familiar with, because I left government in 2018. I think that at the time, the matter was being discussed between the two governments, and it was recognized that there were difficulties in delimiting the EEZ between the two countries because of the position of Turkey on this issue. And I believe that what they wanted at the time was to avoid any to add another controversy on the already very heavy agenda between the two countries. So, but this is my personal opinion. I'm not familiar with any information regarding this issue.
Okay.
But I think this is the reason why it has not been so far delimited.
Okay. Let me finish with a British question. We're talking here from the LSE. I think Alexandros, when he's speaking, talked favourably about the relevance of the UK's military bases on Cyprus. And I guess my question is, how relevant after Brexit you think the UK is in the Eastern Mediterranean? I'm thinking, of course, of the recent agreement between Athens and Paris, which carries a mutual assistance clause in security matters. Athens made some calculation that France was a key player, and the UK was left out of that equation. So in relation to Cyprus, okay, there's the formal position of being a guarantor power for Cyprus and was involved in the recent talks. But de facto, do you think the UK has much relevance in the Eastern Mediterranean? Let me ask you both. Let me start briefly, Emmanuel.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean will become more important for one more reason, apart from, you know, the sovereign bases. This vision about global Britain cannot exist without a strong British presence, both economic and military presence, in the Eastern Mediterranean. So, yes, you are right. We have this new agreement with France, but at the same time, there is an effort from both governments, Greece and the UK, to improve the relation. That's why they signed this new agreement. That's why Prime Minister Mitsotakis visited London. So I think we will see more of Britain in the Eastern Mediterranean. My understanding is that the Greek government, I'm not so sure about the Republic of Cyprus, but the Greek government will welcome the presence of Britain, because at the end of the day, Britain is a European country. So we want European countries, you know, to influence developments in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay. Ambassador Alexandra.
Well, you remember at the time of Brexit, it was said that Britain had left the EU, but not Europe, if my recollection is correct. Well, the role of the British bases in Cyprus is much larger and more global than the Greco-French agreement. They serve a wider purpose in the interest of Western security, because the bases are a part of a global, of a world network, and they have a dual role: monitoring military and non-military, and then the role we have seen the Royal Air Force playing during the ISIS crisis, the bombing of targets, of terrorist targets and bases in Iraq. I think there are two different things. The French are in Eastern Mediterranean because they have interests in the Maghreb. And once a third country set foot on the Maghreb, the French reacted. And of course, by Maghreb, I mean Tunisia and Algeria, neighboring Libya and Egypt. So there is a wider interest of France for preserving its sphere of influence in the Maghreb and for the stability in that area. But it is not global, it's rather regional, while the role of the bases is global. because it is part of a whole network which begins in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia, New Zealand, and extends to the UK and beyond. This is as far as the monitoring, which is in my view, it is the most important component of the basis. And the other one, of course, is the military presence, basically the Air Force, the Royal Air Force base in Cyprus, which serves for the, how should I put it, for homeland security, in the sense that when there is a terrorist threat, they can strike at the origin of the terrorist threat, as we have seen it with ISIS. So I think that there are two different things, and yes, what Professor Karayani said about global Britain and the role of the bases is perfectly true. And we have seen that recently the Ministry of Defense are upgrading the bases. I think an amount of £600 million was mentioned for the upgrading of the British bases in Cyprus. This gives an idea of how precious the bases are for the United Kingdom and its Western allies.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. I think we now have come to the end of our allotted time, so forgive me that we haven't been able to take more questions. Just before I thank our speakers, can I mention that, again, that we hope that a recording of this discussion will be uploaded onto the Hellenic Observatory's website at the LSE. And let me also mention that the last public event that we have for the Hellenic Observatory before Christmas is on Tuesday, the 7th of December. The details are now on your screen. We switch from geopolitics to economics. And Professor Alan Manning from the London School of Economics will speak on minimum wages, lessons for Greece from the international experience. This is part of an LSE National Bank of Greece public lecture series. So do join us if you can for that event. But for this evening, let me give my sincere thanks both to Alexandra Stenon and Emmanuel Karayannis for covering so many different topics in what is clearly both interesting and complex. So thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you at our next event. My thanks again, Alexandra, Emmanuel, very much indeed. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I wish you Merry Christmas, and to keep with the tradition, you owe me an LSE cup.
I do. I do indeed. I would send the LSE cap through the post, but I know that after Brexit, the post is very.
Hope to see you soon.
I look forward to seeing you. Many, many thanks to both
of you. Thank you.